ladies and gentlemen. This is George Leistensnyder speaking. My wife, Ruby, and I would like to welcome you on by means of these colored slides for a trip through a tour of Massachusetts and Connecticut made in October 1960. We went through this part of the country primarily to see the fall foliage, which was at its best in this second week in October. This is a map of Massachusetts with the four principal places we visited marked by the red arrows. We went up the Taconic State Parkway in New York State after crossing at the Bear Mountain Bridge from New Jersey. There are several observation parking areas on this parkway. This is a view of the Hudson Valley near Rhinebeck, which we took at an overlook on the Taconic Parkway. This is a view taken at an overlook about 6 miles north of the last picture. This is still New York State. As we turned into Massachusetts on Route 42, a short distance from Great Barrington, we were in the Berkshire Hills, and at a turnout on the road, this was the scene across the valley of the Berkshires. There were many scenic spots with turnouts on Route 42 as we proceeded toward Otis and Beckett Corners, where the information was that the leaves were at their very best. As we got a little further into Massachusetts, we saw many stands of birch trees covering the hilltop. In this scene, I noticed one tree in the front that looked almost like a rustic cross, so I put on the telephoto lens and got this view. As we drove north through Beckett Corners on Route 8, we came upon a little lake called Rudd Pond. This picture was taken from the car as we passed a colorful spot. A short distance further on, we came upon another scene at another little lake, quite similar to this one. After stopping overnight at Pittsfield, we drove up toward North Adams through fog quite heavy in the valleys, but as we approached the mountaintops, we came out of the fog into bright sunlight and could look back on the fog-filled valleys, as this scene depicts. At the top of Mount Whitmar, we found this observation tower, from which four states can be seen. This little Indian maiden statue welcomes all travelers to the Mohawk Trail, which runs along the Deerfield River. This is the scene of the road going down the mountainside from Mount Whitmore. It's approximately a 12-mile drop down to the valley. The trail is plainly marked with these Mohawk Trail signs, and there's Route 2 in Massachusetts. As we drove along, we passed through hillsides brilliant in foliage and color, particularly of the oak and the maple. This is another view taken from the roadside of the same part of the country, which is quite mountainous at this part. Here we have another view of the mountain scenery. A few miles further on, the country widens out into a wide valley, which is the famous Mohawk Valley of history. This picture was taken across the valley and shows the various homes and farms in that vicinity. This is another view of the same Mohawk Valley, taken near Greenfield. As we drove along, we, of course, kept our eyes out for interesting things photographically, and as we approached Brimfield, this church came into view. This is a very famous place that has been used for photography purposes You've probably seen it in magazines and art color calendars and so forth. I was very glad to get this view of the church. This map is the same as the one we saw earlier, but number two arrow marks the site of Old Sturbridge Village, where we arrived about noon. Old Sturbridge Village is a regional museum of rural New York life. It preserves and presents the story of New England farm and village life of yesteryear and imparts a knowledge and understanding of that heritage to the citizens of today. In the 1920s, two brothers, Albert B. Wells and J. Cheney Wells, who were members of a family prominent and active in central Massachusetts for several generations, and who had a collection of old New England guns and clocks, china, and many other objects found in the houses, barns, and shops of early America, realized that the treasures were important and of great public interest. From this realization came the decision to establish a museum, not just in Glasgow, public interest. From this realization came the decision to establish a museum, not just in glass cases like the city museums, but in a natural setting suggesting the original location and uses of the many objects and in the original buildings wherever possible. The present village site was obtained and the 200-acre tract of farmland laid out in a typical village plan with its commons, roads, paths, and to this site were brought the more than 30 buildings found here today. This village is a recreation of representative New England community of the period 1790 to 1840. The village was first opened to the public in 1946. This is a view of the Quaker Meeting House. This is a meeting house of the Society of Friends in Bolton, Massachusetts, and was built in 1796. This is the herb garden and barn. Herbs widely used in the early days can be seen growing there today and in preparation for culinary uses. This is the John Finow House, erected in 1704 at Canton, Massachusetts. This is the oldest house in the village and its whitewashed walls and its red painted woodwork and simple paneling give this house an individual charm. This is the Stephen Finch House. It was moved to this location from Willimantic, Connecticut, and was built in 1737. Its unpainted half-gambrel roof reflects the plain dignity of the farmhouses of this community in the 1700s. Candle dipping and molding are demonstrated in the summer kitchen. Nearly every village of this period maintained a pillory and stocks at the central part of the village. These are represented at this village. This is Minor Grant's General Store, the rear view. This store was operated well into the 1800s with this curious conglomeration of things that customers wanted or might want. This store was moved from Stafford, Connecticut, and it displays many old-time wares and sells reproductions of the many products from metals to foods. A tin exhibit, cast iron, woodenware, and cookie bakery is on the basement floor. These cookies were exceptionally good, too, believe you me. They sell for a nickel apiece, and they're certainly worth it. This is the front of the general store with benches for the people to idle away a little time on, and they have old sale signs and pickle barrels as it was 150 years ago. This is the General Salem Townhouse, built in Charlton, Massachusetts in 1796 by General Salem Town. This country house was the residence of a man of comfortable circumstances. Its outbuildings, gardens, and furnishings reflect the finest country craftsmanship of New England. This is the barn of the townhouse, and it contains many sleds and chaises and horses and ox-drawn vehicles of the 1800s. You will notice that the areaway between the house and the barn is covered because of the high snows that they have in New England, and it made easy access to the animals and the equipment in the barns. Behind the house runs the Quonnebaug River, and this is a view taken from the garden at the rear of the house. This is a view of the covered bridge, which is across the mill pond at the end of the garden of the townhouse. This is the front of the village tavern. The taverns of the 18th century was the hospitable heart of the village, offering bodily comfort and good cheer to the traveler and to the townspeople. It was a place of refreshment and lengthy arguments about the state of the nation, the village, and even their own souls. This tavern now houses a cafeteria in the basement, a dining room serving buffet lunches, restrooms, and a large exhibit of 1700 art. There is also a beautiful collection of lighting devices from the earliest known days up to the present at the rear of the second floor. This is a rear view of the tavern, where a terrace dining outside of the cafeteria is available when the weather is suitable. Here is the Gebhardt Barn, an uncommonly massive structure. Wall planks were hand-hewn and are 2 inches thick. This structure now houses spinning and textile tools and machinery. This is the Richardson House, built in Podunk, East Brookfield, Massachusetts in 1748. It is an unusually fine example of the detail and proportion of a typical salt box house of the 18th century New England. This is the Mashapog House. In this building are exhibits of homemade textiles, fabrics, coverlets, blankets, and other homespun products that were prevalent in the times of the 1700s. This is the Village Meeting House, a local example of early Greek Revival style architecture. This meeting house was built in Sturbridge Center in 1832 by the Second Oldest Baptist Society in Worcester County, Massachusetts. Moved in 1838 to the Fiscale section of Sturbridge and moved again in 1949 to its present site. Services are held here every Sunday. This is a view of the village commons taken from the church steps. This is a covered bridge that was built at Dummerston, Vermont, where it spanned the Taft River for many decades. This bridge is a latticework construction completely sheathed to protect the structure pieces from weather. Here is the White Grist Mill, reproduced on the site of the original White Mill. Buckwheat, wheat, rye, corn, and graham flours are stone ground and bagged here. The machinery is from the Porter Grist Mill in Hebron, Connecticut. This is the Moses Wilder Blacksmith Shop. This unusual granite structure was built prior to 1820 at Bolton, Massachusetts. Iron is wrought here on a large two-man forge. This is the Tin and Broom Shop. The tinsmith's tools and wares are displayed here, and in the southeast room, a broommaker demonstrates his ancient craft. This is a view of the Freeman Farm. This farm recreates life on a small New England farm of the early 1800s. The farm wife baked her bread, beans, and gingerbread in a brick oven, while stews, soups, and puddings are cooked over an open fire. Oxen work the land. This is a view of the ox cart and oxen, which is driven around the community to show what sort of transportation was prevalent in 1700s. This is the Isaiah Thomas Printing Office, built at Worcester, Massachusetts in 1780. It is famous as a New England printer and publisher of the Massachusetts Spy, which was an exceptionally influential newspaper of that period. Demonstration of wooden flatbed press of 1760 is given by the village printer. At the rear of the gun shop is this pewter shop. This shop houses a collection of pewterware made and sold in the 19th century. The pewterer demonstrates his craft making pewter buttons and spoons. This is the Harrington Gun Shop. Muzzle loading, flintlock, and percussion type cap, bat, muskets, muskets and rifles, blunderbusses, ladies' muffs, pistols, dueling sets, boot and cane pistols are on display. Here's the cabinet shop. In this building are displayed the tools used by early New England housewrights, cabinet makers, and coopers. They are shown and operated actually making furniture. This is the Hitchcock Boot Shop. This house contains bootmakers and cobbler's tools, benches, lasts, and examples of early handicraft footwear. The farmer's neat cattle hides were fashioned into boots and shoes using these implements. Here is the glass shop. In this building is told a step-by-step story of the New England glass industry. On display are raw materials, tools, bottles, glass, window glass, drawer pulls, and paperweights. In the basement are the wool carding machines of the early 1800s. This is a view of the covered bridge near the mill pond. This is a view of the long bridge which leaves the village and takes us back to the parking lot. We proceeded on across Massachusetts and we passed this little church near Concord, Massachusetts. We passed the Wayside Inn of Longfellow's fame near Sudbury, Massachusetts, and stopped and took this picture. The place was not open the day we were there, but you can get meals there most times, they tell us. This is the barn across the road. This is partially destroyed by fire some years ago, but has been reconstructed and the leaded glass replaced and is a real example of buildings of 100 and some years ago. We went on into Boston and took a sightseeing bus, and one of the first places we stopped was at this Paul Revere house. This house contains all of the household goods and many of the examples of Revere's art as a silversmith and everything else that he did. This is the Paul Revere Square with the old North Church in the background. This church, you recall, is the one where the lanterns were placed that advised Revere of the landing of the British, and he began his famous ride. We went on down to Bunker Hill, which we didn't stop the bus, so I couldn't get a picture of it, but we did end up down at Old Ironsides in the Charleston Navy Yard. This is a view of the stern of the Constitution, or Old Ironsides as it was dubbed after the poem was written about it, which saved it from destruction. This is a view of the stern deck of the Old Ironsides from the after boarding from the dock there. This is the bowsprit of Old Ironsides, which is made of one solid piece of heavy ironwood. This is a sign on the mast, which is especially interesting. It gives the details of the tremendous skill that the crew had in the raising the sails and handling the mast of a boat of this type. Some of the letters are obscured in this thing, but it's well worth pausing to read. As we left Old Ironsides, I looked back from the entrance to the dock, and this is a general view of the boat and the dock. It's maintained as a ship of the line by the Navy today, and has a crew assigned to it, and is in a very good preservation. We next went down to Quincy, Massachusetts, which is south of Boston, where we visited the Adams House. This house has been lived in by the Adams family from 1790 to 1927. It was first occupied by John Adams, the second president of the United States, then by his son John Quincy Adams, the sixth president of the United States, then by Charles Francis Adams, minister to Great Britain, and recently by Brooks Adams. It has now been turned over to the government and is maintained as a government reservation. This is another view of the house taken from the side. This is a view of the garden. In this garden are still growing some of the original roses planted there by Abigail Adams in 1750. This again is the map slide, which shows the number 3 arrow where we went down to Plymouth. This is a view of the Mayflower, or rather a replica of the Mayflower, which you may recall was made in England a few years ago and sailed over here. This is another view of the Mayflower taken from the other side of the little peninsula at which it is located. There were men painting the boat the day we were there, and that's what that little boat is pulling away from the side there. This is a view of a pilgrim's home as it was at the time the pilgrims landed or lived at Plymouth Town. This is the covering placed there by the Plymouth Daughters Association over the original Plymouth Rock. This is the Plymouth Rock itself on the beach. Many people think that the Plymouth is the place where the pilgrims first landed, but the story is that they did not land here first, but rather at the end of Cape Cod. There is a large monument placed there called the Pilgrims Monument, and it is in memory of their landing at this spot before they landed at the so-called Plymouth Rock. It was very cold and windy the day we were there, so we didn't stop to take many pictures of Cape Cod, and we hope to return there next year and make a series of pictures. We drove down across through Rhode Island to Connecticut to Old Mystic Seaport. This is the entrance to Mystic Seaport, taken from the parking lot. This is the American Fisheries exhibit, including the Dorothy A. Parsons. This is the Dorothy A. Parsons Chesapeake Bay sloped rigged schooner. It is one of the few schooners left that were used in the oyster business in Chesapeake Bay. It's pointed at both ends so that it cannot be readily grounded. This is a dedication marker placed there listing the names of the people that conceived and created Mystic Seaport as a reproduction of an old New England seaport village. This is a figurehead of a Coast Guard training ship. It was originally taken from a German training ship, or a sailing ship, and is a beautiful piece of wood which has been gilded. This is the anchor from the old whaling ship Wanderer. It's all that's left of this boat. This is a schooner Bowdoin, which is used to go to the North Pole by explorers. It is completely fitted as it was when it was used for that purpose. Here's another view of the Bowdoin, showing the heavy ironwood prow and the side planks, which are necessary to prevent the boat from being crushed in the Arctic ice. This is a side view of the Bowdoin. This is a waterfront street paralleling the docks. The counting house is on the left, the Ella Hugh Spicer counting house. The next is the Edwards house, then the Colgrave figurehead carving shop, Peter Driggs shipsmith's shop, and the Plymouth Cordage and Rope Walk at the end of the street. These buildings have all been brought to this location from various places in New England and are equipped and maintained the same as they were for many, many years. This is the George Greenman and Brothers Shipyard and the Charles Mallory Sail Loft. This is an especially interesting place to visit, as the people here are glad to show you and explain how the sails are made and how the long ropes are twisted and made, and it is very, very interesting. This is the George H. Stone General Store. In this store are sold many souvenirs, such things as whorehound candy, which you very seldom see anymore, all sorts of nutmeg equipment, and it's really quite a novelty place. This is a view of the so-called cigar store Indian at the store entrance. These are rather rare also. This is the Samuel Buckingham house. He was a captain of the seafaring trade, and this house is furnished with all of the things from various parts of the world which he brought back. In the rear was a captain's garden with a well from China and things of that sort, but it happened to be closed for repairs the day we were there, and I could not get a picture of these various things. This is the Bringhurst apothecary shop. In this shop, you see the examples of the many drugs and pseudo-scientific curatives that were used by the seafaring men, and all of the original equipment and balances and bottles and vials and jugs are on display there. A very, very interesting place. This is the original New York Yacht Club building. Many of the old millionaires that had yachts back in the 1800s used this building as their meeting place for their regattas and races. This is the yacht basin at the end of the New York Yacht Club, and the pier here is welcome for anyone with a yacht that wishes to come in and visit. This is, again, the last remaining evidence of a great whaling ship. This is the anchor of the Benjamin F. Packard. This is a historical dory which was used as a life-saving boat and which, if you read the sign, covered some 3,000 miles. The bosun's mate kept track of the days by cutting notches in the gunwales on the port side. They can be seen. The sign gives the story of one of the long trips that this boat made. It's well worth reading. Stillman Building houses a museum which contains many, many figureheads and fine work of the sailors, the scrimshaw work in which they carved pictures and signs and even poems on whalebone and walrus tusks, things of that sort. This view was taken inside the building of some of the figureheads. This is another view of the other side of the building. These cases in the background here contain a very interesting collection of the original relics of Robert Louis Stevenson. Many of the guns and knives and living eating utensils and, in fact, everything that he used in his life in the South Pacific are preserved in these cases. This is the Fishtown Chapel. This is the interior of the chapel, and you see that they have figureheads and flags of famous boats all throughout this chapel. Services are held here, I understand, on Sundays also. This is a Charles W. Morgan whaler, the last of the great whalers. It was used up until a few years ago, and you can see from the sign what all it did. Another view of the whaler. Taken from the dock. This is a view of the whaler taken from the captain's house, which we saw a short time ago, Samuel Buckingham House. You see the captains live right close to their boats in the seaside villages of New England. This is a view of the whaler taken from the Seaport store. Incidentally, this store contains a great variety of antiques and modern goods too, covering seafaring life and boats, and was an exceptionally interesting place to visit. Right behind it is a very good cafeteria, which during the summertime serves excellent meals. We got a very nice dinner there, and I believe that it is only open on weekends during the, after the end of October, however, until spring. As we left the premises of Old Mystic Seaport Village, we passed this sign. This is a view of the submarine which the sign refers to. This is a tremendous thing, and it must have been really something for the kamikaze pilot of this submarine to be expected to approach an enemy ship and by means of firing a gun into the explosive head, explode the submarine and himself as one huge torpedo. We left Mystic Seaport in the afternoon and was very glad to have such a place to visit. We returned to Somerville very happy that we had seen so much of historic New England, and we trust that you, the viewers of these slides, also enjoyed them as much as we did making them. Thank you and good night.